Michael, thank you for making time to visit with me today and to discuss your book, which is entitled Christian Hope Among Rivals, How Life Organizing Stories Anticipate the End of Evil. Thanks again, and I just would like you to begin by telling us a little bit about how you got interested in this topic. It's fascinating.
Well, thanks for talking with me, Jackson. As I thought about what to write, partly it came back to memories of childhood of being afraid of heaven, that if I was going to be bored in heaven. And that was always an interesting topic of eschatology and what exactly are we hoping for. And as I started to do more reading, I learned a lot about eschatology and study of last things and how this had been a real main discussion point for like the last 100 years in the Christian church and among academics. And so as I read more, I saw that sort of my fears of dealing with being bored in heaven really came back to the questions of, can I trust God? Can I trust him to for my happiness, for my eternal happiness? And so then there are even deeper questions under that about can I trust God in the face of evil? And it was just kind of a process of learning for me and trying to figure out what was at the bottom of my what seemed like childish fears of being bored in heaven.
So it sounds like we have really the merging of two concerns, at least two. You have eschatology, which traditionally a lot of Christians listening, I know, will associate that with the end times and the second coming or the rapture, heaven or hell. But then you also mention evil, which gets us thinking about another area within theology and philosophy, and that is theodicy, which is just kind of a way of accounting for the ways of God, especially in the face of evil. So you're kind of trying to bring those two concerns together in this book, is that right?
Right. So I had read an essay out of a big compendium on eschatology, the Oxford Handbook of Eschatology. And there was an essay in there where one of the authors had said something along the lines that all eschatology is theodicy. And really, they're the same concerns. And it was something like eschatology without theodicy, that is, without somehow letting God show his justice or justifying God, however you want to say it, without theodicy, without that, hope is empty. And without a theodicy, without some kind of end resolution, is unfulfilling. So the two were really the same, two sides of the same coin.
Yeah. And we should hasten to add that while to some at this point this may sound like an overly academic type of concern, you use an illustration early in your book that I think helps orient us to thinking about the concerns of people. You mentioned a guy named Sean. It's in the chapter that I love. It's entitled Zombie Jesus. Why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about what that whole anecdote is about?
Sean was a friend of our congregation. We had a men's Bible study that met on Tuesday mornings at a Panera Bread near my church. And Sean was the nephew of an older member. He always saw himself as an outsider, but interested in spirituality, but not wouldn't probably consider himself a Christian, at least in the traditional sense, but was a seeker, maybe you'd say. Well, we were having a conversation in one of those Bible studies, and we were talking about the resurrection of the dead and Easter and the resurrection of Jesus in particular. He had basically said, "So you're telling us that we need to believe in zombie Jesus?" And by him saying it that way, it struck me how really the core of Christian hope is that what became of Jesus is going to become of us, that God will undo death for us just like he did for Jesus. That's not just for us, but for, as Paul says, for the whole created order. He's going to set creation free from its bondage to decay. And this hope to an outsider sounds like a B horror movie. It's kind of ridiculous. So that helped me understand and think through how if someone is going to look at our hope as as fantasy or just plain silly, what do they have as a way to kind of guide their life for some other hope?
Mm-hmm. And that seems to segue naturally into the subtitle, and you have this key phrase that you use, life organizing stories. So give us kind of a succinct definition of what that means and how that relates to this subject.
The way I use it is it assumes that most people who are somewhat sane imagine their lives in, or at least think of their lives as a story. And they are a character, maybe the main character, maybe a supporting character in this story, and that it's going somewhere. It has some kind of resolution. Either that resolution could have already happened, or it could be in front of them, or they could be living out the implications of that happy or ending or resolution. But it's something that we just do naturally to give ourselves order and something to live for.
Mm-hmm.
And this isn't something that you need to believe in the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to do. You don't even need to believe in a deity at all. You can still think of your life in these terms. And it was a helpful way for me to think about someone like Sean. What is the hope that helps him get out of bed in the morning if he doesn't have the same object as me?
So in other words, we traditional Christians have espoused certain eschatological views about heaven and hell, and within that framework, we say we have hope because we believe one day Christ will raise us and we shall be with him. And you're saying in the book, and I heard you say this several times, you're concerned that too many Christians think we're the only game in town.
Yeah.
And that there aren't other rival accounts or rival stories that also give people a sense of hope, even if we believe that hope might be inferior or
right.
Just plainly wrong.
True. So I think it's trying to do two things. One is to, like Paul says to the Ephesians, he says, you were one time without God and without hope in the world. So to sort of recognize that the hope that we have in the crucified and risen Jesus is the only show in town in truth. But to be able to recognize that at the same time, from the perspective of someone who's coming at it from an outsider, just like when Paul was being interviewed by Governor Festus in Acts and he's in chains, the governor says, Paul, you're out of your mind. So from the governor's seat, Paul looks like he's the one who's hopeless. So it's just a way to try to sit in the governor's seat, so to speak, and think through, again, what sort of story does he think does he live in that gives him hope that is could be a rival to mine in the dark moments of my life that I might be tempted by, people in my congregation might struggle with. So it is ultimately a pastoral concern in helping people become more certain of Christian hope, but to be willing to take, I guess, sort of a detour into the hopeful story of somebody else.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned the point about it, this being a pastoral project. You use a number of anecdotes in the book that are very helpful, I think, sizing up different situations that you experienced in your pastoral work that help illuminate this subject. But so in that way, we could say that even though this is a theology project that is going on here, this is motivated by immensely pastoral and practical concerns, but would you also say there's some apologetic type motivation that's driving this project?
Yes, there is. And I actually had a friend review it, sort of, kind of more of a colleague who is an atheist, and or I guess he would probably just see him as like post-secular atheist, not antagonistic, but He gave me good feedback, and my hope for someone like him would be that to help him see how we're all in a way on the same field when it comes to struggling with evil, whatever that is. Now, evil for a Christian is going to look different than an atheist, but we still have this category things that don't quite fit in our story. So we have a story that we tell and that we live out, but there are things that attack that story, things that undermine it. So, for example, for a Christian, I've had a Bible study last night, and one of the members asked the question, you know, why does God do a miracle for some people and not for others? This question of God's sovereign choice, his election, and that could be as simple as the, why did I get spared from an accident when this person didn't? Why is one person led to faith in Jesus and another one doesn't seem to get any opportunities to do that? All these questions that are difficult questions that strike at the Christian story, but also strike at every other story. And so in a way, so that at least my apologetic move there is to try to show how we're all in some ways on the same playing field or level the playing field.
At this point, I think it might become one of the things that probably a listener might wonder is just to frame eschatology as in this particular way that you have as the resolution of conflict. I think probably a lot of people think when they hear eschatology, they think more in terms of specific events. They think of the end times. They think of apocalyptic imagery from Revelation. It's not that you don't want to talk about all of that, but how do those types of concerns fit into the way you want to orient our thinking about eschatology?
It's natural for Christians to think in terms of events because our story is historical by nature. We center ourselves on things that are going to happen in history and have happened. So the resurrection of Jesus, the second coming of Jesus, and all the events leading up to that. We are event oriented, and that's part of our hope. Not every worldview obviously has that orientation, but it doesn't mean they live without a hope for some kind of resolution of conflict. Mm-hmm. So an example would be the famous psychoanalyst Sigmund Freud. He's one of the authors that I engage in this book. He has a powerful hope, but for him the inbreaking or the proleptic moment for him is more of a mental realization that for him it's there is no God. All religion is just a yearning for a parental figure to take care of us. And the aha moment for him, the event, is coming to realize this. And in a sweep, he does away with all the conflict, all the fear of hell or the reward of heaven. All of it's done away with, and now we can be mature people. So that's his hope. It's not looking for a second coming, but it is that it does reference to an event for him, that proleptic or realized moment where the world changed fundamentally for him.
Mm-hmm. So you give at least four alternatives or rivals, rival life organizing stories, and you do associate them, as you said, with certain figures in history, Freud in the case you just mentioned. So let's just play this out a little bit. We're in worship on a Sunday morning, and we are here confessing that Jesus is Lord. We're singing his praises. We're listening to his word. And our hope is organized around the person of Jesus Christ. You're saying that across the street, there's someone else, and they're sitting there on their couch, and they're enjoying food and watching a ball game. And you're saying that even if they don't have the hope we have, they have something they are hoping in. And even if they've never read Freud or any of the other philosophers you mentioned in the book, they have been influenced by those stories as those stories from those philosophers has been articulated and sort of filtered down through culture. People in our communities are living out those stories. Is that kind of a way of putting all of this in a very practical framework?
Absolutely. I just read an article in the news, I think it was Wall Street Journal article today, about a movement to of people who and these are highly educated, highly successful people seeking, how do you get in the zone? Like this is like almost like a cultish religious following of people seeking out. One way it's described is seeking out flow, where you can reach this ecstatic moment where you're outside of yourself. And so they had this, it was about this long retreat that they had where they were in a climate controlled dome, and they were laying on the ground and they were listening to music and kind of doing exercises and stuff. And they were trying to cultivate this ability to get in the zone, so to speak, where you're oblivious to the passage of time, where you can kind of escape from yourself, escape from the worries of the world, and have this ecstasy, not drug induced, but you know, induced through other means. And that is an example of a life organizing story where you have this pursuit. There's a practitioner who can show you the way, and you live in this. You might have a proleptic anticipations of getting in the zone, but they're only for a moment, and then you got to go back to life, and then you keep kind of trying to seek these out. So again, it's not oriented around world cosmic events. It is more of a kind of a personal eschatology, but still powerful.
Maybe that's one of the areas where having a holistic or a comprehensive understanding of biblical eschatology is compelling to such a person, to know that the hope that you and I speak about is not just this personal existential thing, but that it's cosmic in scope.
Mm-hmm.
And it transcends the individual while not losing the individual.
Right.
That's just kind of my gloss on it anyway.
Yeah. And so there's what has been helpful to me in having this approach is that, that's one example, but maybe there's another example. Like I listened to John F. Kennedy's "Go to the Moon" speech.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on YouTube. It's one of the most inspiring speeches I think he ever gave. But it is very much a progress oriented about all the things scientifically and technologically that humanity has accomplished in the last 50 years. And he goes through if humanity. We compressed all human history into the last 50 years. Here's all the things that would have happened in the last minutes, and kind of going to the moon is the next thing. And so that is a very powerful cosmic having to do with the world, that we are progressively getting in more and more control of the world. Technology is allowing us to do things we've never done before. So we can kind of affirm the world aspect of that, but not the human-centric aspect of that. We can see how different hopes are rivals to each other, and we might find an ally in a common rival.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah, and the one you just sketched out, that seems to me, not to try to avoid caricature here, but your kind of traditional or conventional educated secular elite, that's more the narrative or the story they're going to be operating mm-hmm. out of. But you know, you pastor here in St. Louis, and I'm just kind of curious, as you look at the landscape of your community, and most people wouldn't consider themselves secular elites, maybe they have a college degree, maybe they don't, is there a particular story that you find a lot of people that you're trying to reach living into, and maybe even some of your own parishioners, a story that they're particularly drawn to?
There's certainly ones that have are compelling. I think a lot of people live it vaguely in an American dream kind of narrative where we're trying to carve out a better life for our kids and work up the corporate ladder or reach some sort of financial independence and retirement, and that becomes in effect the story they organize their lives around. I think a lot of people also do have the existential escape, trying to find that in video games or sports or whatever. So I think there's the thing about what I'm trying to do in the book is it gives a typology to help us as Christians not lose our bearings, but to also know that every individual, most people are operating with like a conglomeration of these.
Yeah.
And so it helps me, and I think it could help a reader know how to ask questions to try to understand what is your story, realizing there might be kind of pieces of many of them bound up.
Yeah, and I think you just sort of went where my thoughts were as well. One of the things that seems to me to be so difficult for not just general purposes of pastoral ministry, but especially evangelism, is that people have incorporated into their, let's say, worldview. I know that's a taboo word for some people, but let's just call it that. It seems like people have derived content, if I could put it that way, from so many different stories or other narratives into their own narrative, where it becomes difficult to talk about explicitly religious things because people, you know, they would be the first to say, oh, well, yeah, I believe in God, and I believe in Jesus, and I believe you ought to go to church. And yet those affirmations are sort of joined to all these other affirmations about the good life and about what would really give a person hope, you know, their children doing well or them doing well. And it just seems very hard to me to sometimes get to the nub of the matter with people because there's so much explicitly religious language that has been incorporated mm-hmm. into these really other life organizing stories.
Right.
So help us a little bit think more about that. I know you've gotten it all solved, so help us.
Well, one of the things I noticed that in the people who go to my congregation and worship there, and in my own life, trying to sort out the truth from what is false or what is misleading. And the emphasis on story for me has helped me. If I'm going to say I follow Jesus, I worship the God of Jesus, to find out who he is, who his Father is through the biblical narrative. That if I want to know God, I gotta know him through his work through Israel and Jesus and the church revealed in the narratives of Scripture. And so for me, it's pushed me back into the Bible to learn about God, learn about what my proper hope is and what the hope of Christians is by immersing myself in that story.
Mm-hmm.
And to help people as they go through this process of either coming to faith in Jesus or maturing in their faith to start to live in Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John and Acts for mm-hmm. a while. And instead of living in all the hodgepodge of other stories that are pressed on us.
Right. And I don't want to get us too sidetracked here, but you know, one of the things that's interesting about your book is that you discuss subjects that typically, when these subjects are broached by other authors, people go a different direction. So, for example, talking about the problem of evil, it's very common for Christians to move immediately to some kind of free will defense. Or when we're talking about eschatology, common to try to focus on arguments for the historicity of certain biblical events.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to put words in your mouth. Would you say that some of those moves in certain situations could be appropriate, but that can't be the primary means by which we embody the hope that is in Christ or share that hope? Would you characterize it that way, or would you put that a little differently?
I think it's mostly how I would say it. There's a place for talking about human responsibility in the face of evil. There's a place for talking about the historicity of the events of the Bible. But when we bring this story, which we take as the truth, to someone who doesn't, that might not be the first way to lead, I guess. It might not be the opening way to start a conversation. And when we do take this, our hope, to someone like Sean, who we talked about in the beginning, who looks at our hope as kind of ridiculous, to try to come at it from a different angle and look at how he's going to be wrestling with some sort of evil that just isn't easily going to go away, and we are as well. When we get to the bottom of these questions about why some and not others, it's kind of how I summarize the Christian problem of evil. Why does God deliver some from suffering and not others? Is a question that I have to wait for God on. And that's our hope, is that he's going to prove himself trustworthy in the end, even if I can't solve the problem in advance.
Mm-hmm. And maybe a verse that captures that sentiment is 1 Peter 3:15. Always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And so there is that verbal communication and sharing that is appropriate to Christian witness, but that presupposes that people have seen that we do have hope in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think he continues on, do so with gentleness and respect. So to speak to this other person as someone who is truly made in the image of God, has at least some tenuous grasp of truth based on their own investigations and, you know, how in a Christian category of natural revelation, that I can learn something from them. And if I enter into a respectful, humble, gentle dialogue with them, that it's going to teach me something, even if they're not a follower of Jesus.
Mm. Well, Michael, again, we've only scratched the surface, but I just want to say again to our listeners that if this is a subject that interests you, eschatology, the problem of evil, generally how to equip people or to be equipped yourself for thinking about Christian hope, I would just commend unto you this book that Mr. Michael Ziegler has written, Christian Hope Among Rivals, How Life Organizing Stories Anticipate the End of Evil. And that is a Pickwick publication, and it was released the second half of last year. Is that right?
I think so. Yeah, 2017.
Yeah. So again, Michael, thank you so much for sharing these ideas from your book with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.